This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, June 29th, 2004. It was called the Dream Ticket. Democratic nominee John Kerry with Republican Senator John McCain. Writing in the Wall Street Journal, its executive Washington editor, Albert R. Hunt, on June 17th, called looking for the next best dream ticket. Here for the Democratic nominee's pick of a running mate, the dream choice, John McCain. He is more than a candidate referring to Kerry. He's willing to reach out and address the partisan divide in America. The Kerry camp, writes Albert Hunt, should proudly hail the McCain offer as an indicator of the candidate's genuine desire to unite and not divide. A Kerry-McCain ticket not only would have swept the election, but would have been good for the country. Today on Taking Aim, the one big property party.
Statement you were quoting from the Wall Street Journal. I want that to be clear.
Yes.
The looking for the next dream team and dream ticket, I should say, in the Wall Street Journal is a marked indication that the divisions between the two parties are not even any longer rhetorical, nor do the rulers consider that they can afford to contend that there are differentiations that even embrace tactics. It's interesting to note that the dream team that they present of McCain along with Kerry, which they acknowledge entails a unity around the necessity to expand the military, not only in Iraq, but throughout the Middle East and beyond. Both Kerry and McCain have criticized Bush from the far right, maintaining that a red line wasn't drawn in North Korea and that the North Korean government had to be taken out. But in this Wall Street critique on June 17th, there is an assessment of the alternative to McCain as the vice presidential nominee and candidate along with Kerry. And that is John
Edwards
of North Carolina. And what's interesting about their description of the role that Edwards would play is that they ran a test on Edwards. The rap against a freshman lawmaker is that he lacks gravitas and experience. But earlier this month, he spoke at the high-powered and super-private Bilderberg meeting in Stresa, Italy, and two of the biggest figures in the Democratic Party establishment came back raving about his performance. The John Kerry, John McCain ticket would have swept the election and been good for the country, but John Edwards, and he may not be the A-rod of this political season, but for John Kerry, Nomar will do just fine. A reference to Nomar Garciaparra, the Red Sox shortstop, as compared to the Yankee shortstop, or third baseman now, Alex Rodriguez, A-Rod. What we're describing here again is the ruling class coming to the conclusion that in this crisis of the imperial and capitalist system, there is no longer any room for a pretense of tactical divisions between the one big property party with two names. And as you say, Maya, what they're advocating and what they're putting forward is one big property party, a unity government with one name.
It was only a few weeks ago, June 11th, that the Associated Press revealed that Kerry had discussed the vice presidency with McCain on not one, not two, but on several occasions, and most recently in the beginning of June. Although no formal offer was made, and McCain had said that none would be accepted, McCain seriously thought about the proposition. And then the Washington Post reported on the story, and the New York Times gave additional details. When the New York Times revealed that Kerry had talked to McCain at least seven times. And this came from people with inside the Kerry camp. The Los Angeles Times also confirmed that Kerry and McCain have had at least a half dozen or more discussions about the 2004 campaign, and the Los Angeles Times dated it to as early as March, as soon as the Massachusetts senator had emerged as the Democratic front runner. There isn't that much difference, actually, between McCain and Kerry. They may have perhaps gay rights or women's right to choose, but on the major issues of war and the Patriot Act and the compulsory annual testing and so forth of U.S. policies and the relationship with Wall Street, McCain and Kerry work hand in hand.
You're citing again both the Wall Street Journal and indeed David Ignatius's article in the Washington Post, June 11th, reaching out to McCain, in which he states that McCain is, genuinely likes Kerry as a friend, and he has marginal differences, and those are not differences of substance, and indeed they are united on the necessity to bring the two parties into one camp. I am a proud Republican. I revere Ronald Reagan and his party of limited government. The current version of the Republican Party is engaged in a spending binge. They are being steadied and encouraged by the Democrats, McCain declares. But it's interesting to look carefully at this celebration of the one big property party now with one name and not two. Not quite a dream team. John Kerry's foreign policy advisors should give pause, writes Laura Flanders in Common Dreams. And she points to the people who, in fact, are the continuity of the enforcement apparatus, the security apparatus, the intelligence services, the Pentagon, the arms-dependent corporations that sustain policy regardless of nominal administration. She writes, consider Kerry's foreign policy advisors. The advisor they mention first is Joe Wilson, the Clinton-era National Security Council member who worked for George Bush investigating claims that Saddam Hussein was buying weapons-grade uranium in Niger. CIA agent Valerie Plame was supposedly outed by a White House source, celebrated by liberal commentators without noting the fact that both Wilson and Plame were part of counterinsurgency, counterterrorist, and special force operations, Valerie Plame notably in North Africa and in Algeria, under the purview of these liberal mouthpieces.
But the real people who are Kerry's, who comprise Kerry's foreign policy team, those who actually have constructed the foreign policy, are Richard Morningstar, Rand Beers, and William Perry. And Morningstar is a key figure. He was a former advisor to President Clinton on the Caspian oil basin, and he was instrumental in pushing the Baku Tbilisi Sayan oil pipeline. In fact, if you look at Harvard's Caspian Studies program, with which Morningstar was attached, it is funded by Chevron, Unocal, and Amerada Hess, the very oil companies involved in the oil pipeline.
Well, let's look at that, because the consortium of oil companies invested in this project, which is absolutely the catalyst for the pretext of 9/11, which was preceded by the forming of Al-Qaeda, the forming of the Taliban by the intelligence agencies. This consortium of oil companies representing key British and particularly American firms, BP, Unocal, Amerada Hess, worked through the U.S. Export-Import Bank, financing and recruiting. Who were the key figures who were working with the Clinton administration and with this Richard Morningstar in this undertaking for corporate capital? None other than Dick Cheney, James Baker, and James Baker's law offended British Petroleum, even as Cheney's Halliburton, the oil industry supplier, won the contract to build the refineries for the Caspian states with the urging and encouragement and support of Morningstar and the Clinton administration. And the member of the board of directors was Condoleezza Rice, who negotiated the Chevron deal to drill the Caspian's richest fields in the Tengiz. So let's look carefully at this, brothers and sisters. The key advisor to John Kerry is Richard Morningstar, the very figure who in the Clinton administration converged the interests of Halliburton, Cheney, Baker, and indeed Unocal, Amaretta Hess, Chevron, Condoleezza Rice, the pipeline that was designed to bring the oil that had to be seized. That oil couldn't be assumed to be there for them until they seized it. All of the plans since 1964 for the direct seizure of both Middle Eastern and Central Asian oil converge around this dream team, the one big property party of the ruling class.
Also, Richard Morningstar, though not mentioned in Laura Flanders' article, was the ambassador to the European Union, critical in the formulation of the World Trade Organization policy, very much a man for free trade and railing against the European states for what he called protectionist policies. This is Richard Morningstar, free trade, seizure of foreign oil, and hand in hand working with the major oil interests.
And indeed, Richard Morningstar was the national security advisor. The national security advisor, the same role that he will now play with Kerry. So the national security advisor coordinates the oil corporations and the policy of seizing Central Asian oil, and him to be alongside Kerry as the main figure in preparing more of the same.
Before we go on to Rand Beers, who was so important to Kerry's homeland security policies, let's look at William Perry, the Clinton-era Secretary of Defense, who spearheaded a post-Cold War plan to restructure the military-industrial complex. What was Perry's plan? His plan was the consolidation of giants such as Lockheed and Martin Marietta to become Lockheed Martin, the United States' top weapons supplier. As well, aside from Martin Marietta combining with Lockheed, it also included Loral Defense and General Dynamics becoming the mega company. Perry also joined the Carlyle Group, as we all know, the Carlyle Group, of which we here on Taking Aim have spoken many, many times.
Yes, let's remind our listeners that the Carlyle Group is the $14 billion company that was the outcome of the BCCI drug laundered and arms trafficking illicit gangster funding through the aegis of the Saudi royal family and through Khalid bin Mahfouz and through the family of Osama bin Laden into Harkin Energy, Arbusto, and ultimately what was to become the Carlyle Group in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel on the morning of September 11th. Directors of the Carlyle Group sat watching their television screens prior to and throughout the attacks on the World Trade Center.
Now, the Carlyle Group has major investments in both the military-industrial complex, off through direct funding from the Department of Defense, as well major holdings in the pharmaceutical complex, the pharmaceutical industry, which also gets funding from the Department of Defense for the manufacture of bogus immunization drugs. Now, Perry, before he was part of the Clinton administration, was a paid consultant for Martin Marietta. And remember, Martin Marietta was part of the huge conglomeration that he supported, Lockheed Martin. And to facilitate this mega defense industry, these mega mergers, Perry supported the Pentagon underwriting the mergers, what Bernie Sanders called the payoffs for layoffs. In other words, the Pentagon picked up all the costs of moving equipment, dismantling factories, and the golden parachutes for the top executives. After leaving the Clinton administration, William Perry, remember, Kerry's key foreign policy advisor, joined the board of Seattle-based Boeing Corporation, which also depends for its primary infusion of capital from the Department of Defense.
Yes, well, Lockheed Martin and Martin Marietta are also absorbing Laurel Defense and General Dynamics, as you say. So what we have here is the heart, the very center of the national security apparatus, the military-industrial complex, the Pentagon-driven capital, which merges the two parties. Through Clinton and through the Bushes, through Cheney, through Halliburton, through James Baker, through Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., through William John Forbes Kerry.
And, Ralph, what we should also mention, because people think of Lockheed Martin primarily for the military-industrial complex work it does, but Lockheed is one of the prime recipients of federal funding as well as state and county funding for its computer indexing of government documents, whether it is the welfare documents or other types of documentation and computer work that happens in many of the departments, such as Department of Justice or Department of State, and also, at, as I mentioned, the state and county levels. Now on to Rand Beers. Rand Beers is a very interesting character because he is somebody who has worked in the National Security Council under Presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and the current President Bush. Ralph?
Nothing so clearly demonstrates what we have so often attempted to explain to our listeners, that there is but one capitalist ruling oligarchy, that 1% that owns 90% of the national wealth, and that the two political parties are their instruments, their vehicle, their means through which they have hijacked the state and used the state apparatus to subsidize the needs and interests of the capitalist class. It is the executive committee of the capitalist class, as Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels said so simply and eloquently and clearly in the Communist Manifesto. Nowhere is it better manifested and displayed than in the person of Rand Beers, counterterrorism advisor to President Bush, now John Kerry's principal figure in described as the, quote, hero of the Democratic Party loyalty, anybody but Bush crowd, writes Sean Donahue in his article in Counterpunch called The Toxic Career of Rand Beers, Kerry's drug war zealot. He served as national security advisor, as you say, and he is considered to be the candidate to be either the national security advisor or the secretary of state of a Kerry administration. But he was assistant to secretary of state for the international narcotics and law enforcement affairs and one of the chief architects for the policies in Colombia. He was running the death squads in Colombia. He was running the crop fumigation program introduced in southern Colombia, which was devastating the poor farmers who grew coca while facilitating the chemical cocktail, as it is called, that is used for the actual making of crack cocaine. At the same time, they were destroying the poor farmer base, which was a source for the guerrilla movement in Colombia. They were sustaining the actual narcotics and cocaine manufacturing throughout Colombia. The State Department hired, under Rand Beers's direction, DynCor, the private military contractor. And indeed, it's not just DynCor, but Titan Corporation, which then turns up in the administration of torture in Iraq. It becomes clear to us, does it not, that we have one happy family of war criminals that populate the parties of capital and the administrations of Bush, Clinton, and now potentially of Kerry.
And under oath, Rand Beers thought he could get away with saying whatever he pleased, but he was caught in the act. When Ecuador's farmers sued DynCor, there was a federal lawsuit, and in a February 27, 2002 deposition, then Assistant Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, Rand Beers, made a statement. Quote, it is believed that the FARC, meaning the guerrilla movement in Ecuador, he says, It is believed that the FARC terrorists have received training at Al-Qaeda terrorist camps in Afghanistan. And then he was caught out. And he had to correct not only that statement, but many other statements that he had made. And you can go to narconews.com to read the full deposition and his retractions.
Well, what we're talking about here is not just statements that he made, Maya, but the invention.
Excuse me, in Colombia, the FARC.
The invention of an all-embracing Al-Qaeda that is the presumptive organizer of the mass peasant movement in Colombia, which has been in existence since 1946 in Colombia, but is now being represented by Rand Beers as an Al-Qaeda construct. Now, what's interesting about that is that this man was the top White House counterterrorism officer with a steel door to his office, an intelligence vault secured by electronic keypads, combination locks with alarms. And indeed, he was responsible for the classified reports about the supposed terror apparatus of Al-Qaeda monitoring the shoot bomb. I'm quoting here from the Washington Post on June 16th, Lauren Blumenfeld. Responsible for the shoot, bomb, burn, and poison. And suddenly, as he was staring at color-coded threats, I'm quoting from the Washington Post, he called his wife and he said, "The nation astonished Washington," but what he did know next, according to the Washington Post, was even more astounding. 8 weeks after leaving the Bush White House as one of the chief figures involved in the operation of the counterterror plans and of the Homeland Security apparatus, 8 weeks after leaving this, he becomes the National Security Advisor to John Kerry. And as the Washington Post says, all of which points to a question, what does this intelligence insider know? Heavy with implication that what was in preparation here was another 9/11 scale attack, and that there is division about the appropriateness or the effectiveness or the ability to get away with it. Key to this, no single issue has defined the Bush presidency more than fighting terrorism, and no issue has been more animated amongst Democrats. And it goes on to show and to say that this is an insider from the National Security Council, from Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and the current Bush, who now is the defining figure for a potential Kerry administration with the same set of objectives and the same intelligence credentials.
Ralph, it is Rand Beers who determined what the so-called terror alerts, the different color-coded, would be. That's what he was doing in reading the thousand or so reports that were crossing his desk and meeting with the, quote, threat matrix meetings that track the CIA on CIA spreadsheets. These were the meetings that are held, and he said that before September 11th they met three times a week, but after September 11th they were meeting twice a day for their threat matrix meetings. But what's most interesting to Post article is that none of these panned out. As the Washington Post said, they didn't pan out. Often, these top secret reports came from a disgruntled employee or spouse. And here we have Rand Beers, because what he said was the Bush administration wasn't doing it. Acts John Kerry, who will reinforce the Patriot Act and reinforce the CIA and reinforce the FBI and reinforce all the domestic spying operations on the people of the United States.
Well, one last word here about Mr. Rand Beers. I cannot think of a single instance in the last 30 years of a person who has done something so extreme, said Paul Light of the Brookings Institution. He's not just declaring that he's a Democrat after serving as Bush's point person for national security. He's declaring that he's a Kerry Democrat, and he wants to get his former boss out of the White House, having worked in three Republican administrations and now a registered Democrat, leaving the National Security Council, quote, for personal reasons, unquote, having replaced Oliver North for Reagan as Director of Counterterrorism and Counter-Narcotics, known as the Office, I'm quoting from the Washington Post, of Drugs and Thugs. Of Drugs and Thugs, indeed. And the thug is now showing up as the point man for John Kerry when it comes to national security affairs. And as you say, Maya, what they're preparing for is a huge ramping up of the Patriot Act operations in the United States and the crackdown that that implies.
And, but Ralph, before we go to the crackdown here in the United States and the escalation of the war abroad, let's look at Hacker's Wall Street. While it has been noted that Wall Street provides more money to President Bush, Wall Street remains the primary backing for John Kerry, too. If you look at his top funders, what they are called, the bundlers, those who gather up the several thousand dollar contributions into the $100,000 and $200,000 bundles. The major bundlers are these law firms for the corporate interests. And some of these corporate interests are the corporate interest of John Kerry and his wife, Hines, from the Hines family fortune. If you look at Hollywood's and Wall Street's backing of Kerry by Christopher Wallen, that appeared April 27th in Insight of the News, it reveals from the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, a study they did, Louis Sussman, Citigroup's vice chairman, is one of Kerry's biggest fundraisers. And his nearly half of Kerry's biggest financial supporters, although they contributed more money to George Bush than to Kerry, they still were major contributors and bundlers for Kerry. For instance, Goldman Sachs, the Wall Street firm, an investment company, is number six among Kerry's top givers. And the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Henry Paulson, and the managing director, George Walker, are Bush pioneers who've raised over $100,000 for the campaign, but still, Goldman Sachs is six givers.
Well, as you say, the Center for Responsive Politics has established that half of Kerry's largest financial supporters have given more money to Bush, but the major funding to Kerry for his campaign. In fact, it's not just that Citigroup is one of the major contributors to Kerry, and that its vice chairman is Kerry's largest fundraiser, but the president of Citigroup is George Bush's largest fundraiser. So you have here in the very persona of Citigroup itself, the clearest demonstration of how the funders and the controllers and the operators of these frontmen politicians, these puppets in the hands of those who pull their strings, both financially and in every other way, are operated out of the same office, out of the same company, out of the same Wall Street address. Citibank and Goldman Sachs are the heart of finance capital in the United States.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Our program today, One Big Property Party. An article by M. Asif Ismail of the Center for Public Integrity, Kerry Carries Water for Top Donor. And it's from April 5th, 2004. Washington, May 7th, 2003. This is an article that goes back about John Kerry and who was contributing to his campaigns. The Boston-based Mintz Levin Cohn Ferris PC has been the biggest financial backer of the Massachusetts Democrats' two-decades-long political career in elected office. Its employees contribute couple hundred thousand to Kerry's various races, including his presidential campaign. What's interesting to note is that this particular law firm is a law firm for clients such as AT&T, Wireless Service, XO Communications, and Sailor Telecommunications and Internet Association. The CTIA is the trade association of the wireless industry. Its more than 320 members include carriers, manufacturers, and wireless internet providers. And the CTIA-affiliated companies and their employees also made major contribution to Kerry's campaigns. Among them, Verizon, which donated close to a third of the money from that was contributed by the CTIA. Now, Kerry and his wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, have substantial holdings in the telecommunications company. Almost $50 million of their combined fortune is held in this industry. What's interesting about all this has been Kerry's positions in the Senate in terms of advancing the direct interests of the CTIA. Ralph?
Well, look, this theme has been so amply documented. Here is CNN, "A Democrat the Street Might Like." And this is written in January 21st, after he had won the Iowa primary. "He has the most in Wall Street campaign contributions. He is best for the market, like." And it talks about how the Journal of Finance, and which is a controller of the analysis of the index of stocks similar to the S&P 500, demonstrated that Kerry was in fact an emblem of the sort of figure the street's favorite Democratic candidate in terms of campaign contributions. And it continues, "Kerry and Bush combined to raise $313 million to get a $400,000 a year job. These are contributions, but the group investing that much is expecting a return. When the campaigning is over, we will have, and I'm quoting, a multi-billion dollar government, which is why they vote for war spending and is why the oil starts flowing, so the profits will follow." Now, could it be more explicit than that? Do we need any more articulation of what this charade is really about? Kerry gets a lifeline from Wall Street. The Wall Street Journal, February 17th. "Blair Efron, the vice chairman of UBS Investment Bank, has hosted Wall Street power brokers and New York corporate leaders in his Park Avenue apartment to hear a pitch for Senator John Kerry's presidential bid. Dozens showed up. The Blackstone Group and its chairman, Pete Peterson, Wesley Clark's own presidential campaign manager, Yankee Entertainment and Sports Network chief Leo Hendry, who had donated funds to Richard Gephardt as well. In fact, the Democratic establishment and its deep-pocketed supporters in Wall Street were all there. Backers see Wall Street and the New York business community as key to their efforts. I'm calling everyone I know. I'm getting Stephen Robert of Robert Capital Management Group, who considers himself a moderate Republican. Every day the Republicans call me and say, I want to get on board with Kerry. They're very worried about the direction of the moment. Mr. Robert, the head of the Oppenheimer Group, Inc., one of 20 major fundraisers, had a private dinner with Kerry at the Hilton in New York earlier this month and arranged a huge fundraiser for him. Merchant banker Stanley Schumann, venture capitalist Alan Petrikoff, the list goes on and on.
One of the top economic advisors, a member of his Kerry's so-called war room, is Roger C. Altman, the high-ranking Treasury official in the early Clinton years. And who does Altman bring along with him? He brings along with him, according to the New York Times article on March 28th by Louis Uchitelli, he brings along with him Felix Rohatyn, the investment banker and one-time ambassador to France in the Clinton era, Blair Efron, the investment banker at UBS Warburg, Thomas Steyer, a California investment banker, Stephen Ratner, the founder and managing partner of the Quadrangle Group, a private investment firm. So we have here the interconnection of Wall Street and John Kerry, the one big property party.
There was an interesting article as well in the Observer, the Sunday Observer in London, on this theme on February 15th. Kerry will have to face up to tough questions, focus on the senator's love of lobbyists. John Kerry has received more money directly from lobbyists over the past 15 years than any other serve. His close links with lobbyists have raised eyebrows among supporters used to his campaign slogan, "From the moment I take up office, I shall stand up to the special interests." Well, who are these lobbyists? The telecommunications industry, Michael Woolley. The top political aide is a registered lobbyist for AT&T. Kerry has taken hundreds of thousands of personal dollars from the Boston lobbying firm Mintz, Levin, Cohn, Ferris, and Glofsky. His brother, Cameron, is a lawyer for the company which represents the communication firms Cellular Telecommunications and Internet Association. It isn't it surprising that between 1992 and 2002, Kerry sponsored a series of bills and co-sponsored six more advantageous to CIA's direct corporate interests. And the article goes on with marvelous detail about all of this 15 years lobbying undertaking resulting in specific legislation that benefits these corporate purchasers of this mercenary for hire in the realm of hundreds of millions, indeed of billions of dollars, ultimately in the contracts they receive, in the favors that are directed to them, in their control over the state apparatus, through the purchase of such politicians as John Kerry and the Democratic Party.
Ralph, John Kerry considers himself one of the new Democrats, and who take their direction from the Democratic Leadership Council that had been set up by Al Fromm, and of which Clinton was a chair, and also then Joe Lieberman. And the DLC has proposed over the last decade, and proudly touts on its website, that work-based welfare reform instituted by the Clinton administration, charter schools, which undermine the public school system and the teachers' unions throughout the United States, the community policing and privatization of Social Security, and also the shift in Medicare from a federal program to being a block grant program, which also will decimate the Medicaid program, in the states. And they support the changes in Medicare, as I mentioned, and Social Security, which are privatization proposals. And these are the people who promote the policies for John Kerry. But most of all, with the DLC, if you look at a document that was written by the DLC, comparable to the PNAC's document for the which was to become the Bush administration, the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, wrote a document called Progressive Internationalism, a Democratic National Security Strategy, which is available on the web, on the internet, at its think tank site, the PPI. And it's an interesting document in that it's almost line by line reflected in Kerry's speech at UCLA, which defined his foreign policy. Ralph?
Well, before we go into that, Maya, I think it's worth mentioning that the Los Angeles Times on the 27th of June did an estimate of the Heinz fortune, which had been reported in other newspapers as valued at $1 billion. The Los Angeles Times estimates, and it's in fact rather well, documents rather well, is $3.2 billion dollars, actively managed every day by the by major capital firms, Gannett, Anheuser-Busch, Pfizer, Procter & Gamble, amongst those who are involved in all of this, the Mellon Financial Group. The Heinz Trusts entail 890 trades in stocks, bonds, and funds for every day, all of them valuing in the millions of dollars each and every trade. They are the potentially the richest couple to enter the White House in the history of the United States.
Yes, it's an interesting study, Ralph, that the Los Angeles Times did, because they went through public records. And previously, the Heinz Kerry fortune, based on Teresa Heinz's, the fortune that she inherited from her dead husband's family, was estimated at $500 million. And what the Los Angeles Times did is meticulously go through the public records, and they said this is vastly underestimated and that it's really valued at $1 billion. Certainly, John Kerry cannot be called a man of the people or someone with the interests of the people at heart. If you look at who his advisors are, and you also look at the very statements he has made. And I think the one that is most revealing is the speech he gave at the University of California at Los Angeles, February 27, 2004, fighting a comprehensive war on terrorism. Ralph, did you have something you wanted to mention?
I'm convinced we're going to have to do a second part here, Maya, because the voluminous material on the support of the Patriot Act and on the plans for major military expansion, it's not just the addition of 40,000 troops, but it's the intensifying the war in all arenas. One specific reference here, namely his call for a 5% cut in corporate taxation. That demand by Kerry of a 5% cut in corporate taxation flows from a plan to facilitate the offshore avoidance of taxes altogether, which is a subject in itself. Jury and Benden in the Political Economy of Taxation details it. All the major corporations now are anchoring themselves offshore, where they simply have subsidiaries do their nominal manufacture, and they avoid taxation altogether. That's what Kerry represents. That's what the Democratic Party is about. That's what the ruling class serves. Those are the people who are its masters.
Most, though, on people's mind at this moment, in survey after survey throughout the United States, whether it's a Gallup poll or a CNN poll, is the concern for the war in Iraq. And John Kerry's speech, as I mentioned before, at UCLA, February 27, 2004, fighting a comprehensive war on terrorism, goes line by line, essentially, through this DLC document and shows his promotion of war, the extension of war, and with it, the deepening of the Patriot Act. As he says, the war isn't just a manhunt, a checklist of names from a deck of cards. In it, we do not face just one man or one terrorist group. We face a global jihadist movement of many groups from different, but all committing to assaulting the United States and free and open societies around the world. And he quotes CIA director, former CIA director, who was then CIA director, George Tenet, who said, "They have autonomous leadership. They pick their own targets. They plan their own attacks." And then Kerry goes on to say, "At the mental of those who would use any means and attack any target to impose their views." He says that this war on terror is a clash of civilization against chaos, of the best hopes of humanity against dogmatic fears of progress and future. If you go back and you look at the President Bush's speech at West Point, his seminal speech there, and you look at Dick Cheney's speeches and Donald Rumsfeld's speeches, you find the very same verbiage. But what John Kerry states stated at UCLA, and he states over and again in all his speeches, quote, "I do not fault George Bush for doing too much in the war on terror. I believe he's done too little." And he's very specific. North Korea and Iran continue their quest for nuclear weapons, weapons which one day could land in the hands of terrorists. We have a homeland security strategy that falls short of the vulnerabilities we have and the threats we face. He calls for vigorous law enforcement and an unremitting effort to shut down the flow of terrorist funds. Ralph?
Kerry will expand the military as president, writes Mike Wilson from the Associated Press on December 17, 2003. He makes clear, it is not just about 40,000 additional troops in Iraq, but it is about expansion of the military to take on the necessity to occupy other particular targets of Senator John Kerry is Saudi Arabia, orchestrating this continuously how Saudi Arabia is the repository of terrorism, and Saudi Arabia holds 25% of the established reserves, and Saudi Arabia is a candidate for direct American intervention. That's what all of this destabilizing of the Saudi royal family is about, and that's what the demonizing of the Saudis as the authors of the attacks on 9/11, as if this handful of feudal satraps in Riyadh would take on American imperialism on their own, as opposed to being instruments of a far more fundamental center of power in the nationalist security establishment of the United States itself.
As our listeners will recall, DEPCA contended that terrorists were here, there, and everywhere in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, and in sleeper cells throughout the United States. Well, John Kerry supports this notion, as he states in this speech. There are agents of terrorism who work and lurk in the shadows of 60 nations on every continent. And he says, further, we can't wipe out terrorist cells in places like Sweden, Canada, Spain, the Philippines, or Italy just by dropping in green berets. Instead, he wants to join with the local police forces, in other words, unify the work of the military and the police and military throughout the world. But he does not object to preemptive action at all, he states. First, if I am president, I will not hesitate to order direct military action when needed to capture and destroy terrorist leaders. Ralph.
The Senate votes for larger army, 93-4. 93-4, approving the addition of the 20,000 and then an additional 20,000 troops to be sent to Iraq. And indeed, the defense budget, according to the Associated Press, will top $1 trillion, $770 billion that has been voted, not $416 billion as has been reported in the press. For as Robert Higgs points out in a seminal article, these are cooked numbers. The $416 billion, it's not only that it doesn't include cost overruns, but the $416 billion does not include the militarism funds, the arms funds that go into State Department and Department of Justice, and under blank categories that involve counterinsurgency, special forces, special weapons systems, and intelligence operations, which in fact, as Robert Higgs documents, bring this to $770 billion, which is an 80% increase in the nominal sum, and that's just for 1 year.
Ralph, this is not verbiage from John Kerry, as you pointed out. In the Congress, he has voted. He votes just the way he speaks, and he states specifically, we must stay in Iraq until the job is finished. And what he means by the job is the privatization of Iraq and the creation of a security force that protects the American interests in Iraq. And this is the same. He says that President Bush and the Republican Party is not doing enough. There needs to be more troops in Afghanistan, more troops in Iraq, and intervention in other places throughout the world, and in the United States, the reinforcement of the Patriot Act, not the elimination of the Patriot Act, but the reinforcement of it with intelligence agencies working more closely together and with more surveillance. And specifically, he says, with increasing the identity checks and the computer programs that allow the consolidation of identity checks here in the United States and internationally.
The implementation of all of the elements of Patriot Act, too. The expansion of the Patriot Act is designed to, as Kerry himself describes it, apprehend potential terrorists before they act. And in the Robert Higgs piece, The Defense Budget is Bigger Than You Think, that I cited on January 18th, 2004, from the San Francisco Chronicle, he states the $754 billion is 88% larger than has been acknowledged. And he it's important to take note that on the 25th of June, the vote in the United States Senate for this allocation was 98-0. 98-0. One big property party, no longer with two names, but with one.
We will have to go on to a second part, but I want to end with a statement that Ralph wrote for the excerpt of the statement that Ralph wrote for the Million Worker March. The full statement is on the Million Worker March website, millionworkermarch.org, in which Ralph posed the feat of George Bush change when the Democratic Party, who brought us NAFTA, the MIA, Fast Track with Disney, and JCPenney paying Haitian workers 21 cents per hour. Will the defeat of George Bush end privatization and the destruction of unions in the public sector when the Democratic Party privatized and outsourced our jobs under the rubric of downsizing government? I'd like to interject here that many people have said that you must support John Kerry because that will lead to the defeat of George Bush. But as we have shown in the program today, and as these questions spell out in great detail, the defeat of George Bush with the election of John Kerry will not change life for you and me and all of us here in the United States or those who deserve change internationally. Ralph, to continue.
Well, Maya, the defeat of George Bush presumptively will not end privatization or the destruction of unions. It's the Democratic Party which privatized and outsourced the jobs. And what were downsized were social services, while corporate profits and the military sucked trillions of dollars taken from the sweat of our collective labor. Indeed, the defeat of George Bush presumptively will not bring a crash program to restore our decaying and devastated public schools. The defeat of George Bush will not rebuild our inner cities with free, modern, state-of-the-art housing and an end to homelessness. The defeat of George Bush will not lead to a national training program for skills and capacities to enlist our people in rebuilding this country. It will not end the criminalization of poverty or the prison industrial complex that has destroyed generations of black and Latino youth. It will not roll back the bipartisan union-busting and anti-labor legislation, such as Taft-Hartley, that has been on the books with both parties supporting it for 67 years. It will not provide a free modern transit system every city and town. Indeed, John Kerry has demonstrated and stated that he will intensify the Patriot Act's crackdown in the United States, and he will provide sanction for secret arrest, detention without trial, and the labeling of opponents as terrorists. That is the gravamen of the need of our constituency, the vast majority of our people, to mobilize for our own agenda, to organize, as the Million Worker March organizing committee has summoned working people, labor unorganized and organized, the interfaith community, the anti-war movement, all who understand what is at stake here with the national security state, our agenda, our demands, our requirements. That's what's at stake here, brothers and sisters.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, One Big Property Party. It is will be available on our internet site, www.takingaim.info. For audio cassette or CD copies, contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net, that's PACBELL.net, or takingaim@wbai.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, California, 94591. Ralph?
Stay tuned next week, brothers and sisters, for the most demonstrative evidence of the preparations for permanent war and permanent crackdown from a John Kerry administration, no less than that of George Bush.